Welcome back to my series on moral theology. My name is Father Cody, and we are now part three. As I mentioned in part two, these first five chunks, or the first five sessions, are kind of like a kaleidoscope or a circle, where they talk about different points of the circle pointing towards the middle, so that all these principles make sense once we put the picture together and start applying them in the last 4 weeks of this series. So, without further ado, let us begin. Today, we're talking about principles of morality. These are principles that govern situations that don't go the way we think they should, or are more complicated than we wish. Because, as we're very aware, there's lots of moral situations that are very complicated, or tricky, or strange. And so these principles help us govern the very topics we discussed before. What happens when our actions aren't quite what we hoped, or our intentions aren't as good as we hoped? What do we do? So let's dive in. First one, the principle of double effect. The principle of double effect comes into morally ambiguous situations in which we have a good intention with a bad outcome. For instance, can I kill a person who is attacking me? Self-defense. Or, can I do harm in order to make good come from it? For example, a surgeon. A surgeon has to harm a person's body in order to allow healing to occur. How does this principle apply? The classic example to help us understand the principle of double effect is self-defense. What if someone is attacking me with the intention of killing me? Do I have to let them kill me? Do I have to protect myself? What am I allowed to do? So as another moral principle, we are always allowed to defend ourselves. We have the right to life. So in that way, if someone is choosing to kill us, we have a right to defend ourselves. What that means can be very ambiguous. So for instance, if someone intends to kill me, but have no means to kill me, can I kill them? No, because I really am not threatened. I think I'm threatened. But let's change the scenario. If someone's pointing a gun at my head and saying I'm going to kill you, do I have a right to defend myself? Absolutely. Can I kill the person? If necessary. It is not always necessary to kill a person, and we should strive to do what's best, which would be to protect ourselves and keep the other person alive. But that's not always possible. So in this very unfortunate situation in which we are being threatened and the other person may not live because of it, yes, it is a moral decision to be able to kill that person in self-defense. So here we go. With that in mind, let us head into the basics of the principle of double effect. These are the conditions that are necessary for the principle to apply. Listen to them very carefully. After I have gone through all four principles, then I will go through and put them into application in situations in which they apply and ones in which they don't. The first condition. The act in itself cannot be intrinsically evil or morally wrong. We are never permitted to perform an immoral action even with a good result. Our actions must always be morally permissible for any principle of moral theology to apply. Again, the act in itself cannot be intrinsically evil or morally wrong. Condition 2. The intention must be good. We can never intend an immoral action even though the result may be good. The intention must be good. Principle 3. The bad effect cannot cause the good. Many times we use the phrase that ends justifies the means. This is not true. If the action is immoral, then the ends are still colored by the immorality. Therefore, the bad effect cannot cause the good. We cannot will the means to an end. Principle 4. The good effects of the action must outweigh the bad effect of the action. This is called proportionality. We must always work towards greater good, not greater evil. Hence, the good effects of the action must outweigh the bad effects of the action. With those four principles in mind, let us apply them or put them into practice. So here's a common situation that we mull around with in more of a theoretical sense, but it still shows some of the challenges of the principle of double effect. It is killing Hitler. Let's say we invented a time machine, and this time machine lets us go back to 1938 while Hitler is on his rise to power. We are given this ideal opportunity. Knowing what we know, we have the opportunity to kill Hitler and have no repercussions from it, which means if we were able to kill Hitler, then we could stop World War II, We can stop the calamities of the 20th century and stop the extermination of the Jews during the Holocaust. Should we do it? Can we morally kill Hitler? Well, let's look at our principles, because this situation is where the principle of double effect applies. We have a good intention, stopping war, stopping extermination of people, with a bad outcome, the killing of a person. Is the act of killing Hitler immoral? Yes, you can't kill someone. That's taking someone's life, and it's not in self-defense. He is not currently threatening us. He's not personally threatening me. The threat is more of an ambiguous threat. Even if we were to go back in time, we cannot guarantee that Hitler is going to do the same thing again. In the same way, there are lots of other things we could do. Arrest him, mobilize him, change the propaganda around it. We have many more options besides strictly killing him. Therefore, principle one comes into effect. The act in itself cannot be intrinsically evil or morally wrong. Killing Hitler is intrinsically evil and morally wrong. Therefore, we cannot do it. It is immoral. Situation two, a common one today, death with dignity. Many modern medical practitioners have thrown around this idea of helping people overcome their suffering by ending it quickly, namely a lethal dose of morphine or the cocktail which ends the life by stopping the heart. Can we, with the good intention of preventing suffering, do the evil act of killing someone? Well, no, just like the Hitler situation. Even though we are helping someone out by ending their suffering or making their life easier, we still have the intention of killing the person. Now, there is a way around this, and we'll talk about this more eloquently when we talk about medical ethics, that we can end someone's suffering or mitigate it without the intention of killing them. There's lots of doses of morphine that'll ease suffering and visibly ease their suffering, but is not with the intention of killing. Therefore, the idea of death with dignity, of allowing someone to die because of a lethal dose of something, is immoral. It violates principle two, the intention must be good. Intention, in this case, is bad. Here's a classic example of the principle of double effect. It's one that's kind of challenging, so bear with me. Ectopic pregnancies. Ectopic pregnancies are a situation in which the egg is fertilized in the fallopian tube and implants in the fallopian tube. That is not where it should implant. This is a very serious health issue for that woman. Many times the baby will start to grow even though it cannot. It cannot receive the nutrition, it cannot be viable as it would in the uterus. And if it does continue to grow or continues to develop without the woman knowing, it can lead to severe hemorrhaging, bleeding, and even death. This situation is very severe. Now we have a similar issue going on which makes the principle of double effect apply. This is a child. So by attacking or assaulting the embryo in any way is considered an abortion and the death of that child. So what do we do? Either the child dies or the mother and the child die, or we have very serious health issues. What can we do? Now this is where we have to be creative, because a lot of times we think of moral situations in very black and white terms, as though there's only one possible outcome, or two possible outcomes, and we choose between them. In this case, our two possible outcomes are, we kill the child and medically extract it, doing physical harm to it, which is immoral, or we let the baby develop and kill the mother, or seriously harm her. Those seem like horrible outcomes. Why would we think either of those should be the best moral solution? Well, there is another way around it, and this is where we have to get our creative juices flowing. What if our intention, let's start with action. Let's say our action is to remove a damaged part of the fallopian tube, which is essentially what is happening. The baby is damaging the fallopian tube. That is not how things should be. And so our action is to surgically remove a piece of the fallopian tube. Our intention is to prevent further disease or to prevent further harm to the woman. The baby, or the death of the baby, is simply an unfortunate outcome. So that the good we're doing, saving the mother's life and preventing further medical complications, outweighs, unfortunately, the death of the child. This is how all these principles apply now. As we see the various principles of action, removing the fallopian tube, intention, preventing further harm, and then the circumstances of an unfortunate type of pregnancy, yes, that is a moral decision. We can remove a piece of the fallopian tube and therefore prevent the death of the mother, but cause the death of the child. Some may argue that that's an abortion. And I understand where they're coming from, that most abortions are simply the removal of a fetus. Now, in this case, however, the removal of the fetus is not in a standard means, nor are we technically removing it. We're removing the fallopian tube and what it's attached to. The death of the baby is inconsequential in this case, because it would have normally died anyways, and we're doing no physical harm to it. It dies naturally. Since it would have died, we are literally just letting it die naturally. That's why it's not technically an abortion. An abortion would be the baby has been developing naturally and is in a normal situation, and we do physical harm to it to cause its death. That's not the case in this case, which is why it is a moral decision to remove a piece of the fallopian tube with the baby attached to it without doing harm to the baby, causing sterility in the mother, but therefore preventing her death, thus preventing two deaths. There are lots of other situations in which the principle of double effect applies, and so I'm sure you can come up with many more, but we're going to move on to the next principle, the principle of cooperation. The principle of cooperation is one of those principles that applies in many, many situations and gives us a huge breadth of ideas and concepts to work with as we wrestle with the moral implications of our actions. The principle of cooperation asks the question, how complicit was I with the immoral action? Let me give you some ideas. So I think it's better to start with a scenario and then work from there. So I'm going to use my classic example of a bank heist. So I'm performing a bank heist. Spent months planning this out carefully so that I can go into the bank, steal the money, and keep that money, not go to jail. I, being the one who performed the bank heist, am morally responsible for everything that happens. Without me, it would not happen. This is called formal cooperation. I am the one doing the action. I am the one performing the bank heist. Now, normally, bank heists are not a solo operation. They take some work. You need a getaway car, you need support, you need to make sure everything in the bank functions properly, maybe you need some insider information, stuff like that. So although I am the one that's formally responsible for the bank heist, there are others around me who have also done part of the heist. Let's say I have an inside man, someone who works for the bank and has given me details on the schematics of the bank, maybe bank passcodes, maybe he explains to me how the shifts work so that I can be there in between shifts or not on certain shifts. He is giving me immense information on the bank so that my bank heist goes well. He is not formally cooperating. He did not steal the money. He did not physically open the safe. But he is cooperating with my immoral act of robbing the bank. This is called informal or material cooperation. He is providing the means through which I am being successful. He's not the sole means, because I still do it, but he's very, very responsible to the extent that he's given me the information that I may succeed. The same thing would work if I had companions. Let's say I had three friends who held the tellers at gunpoint so that I could rob the bank. They are materially cooperating in the sense that they are providing the means through which I can successfully hold this bank heist. They did not steal the money. Let's advance this even further. So there's a guy outside in a car. He is fully in on this. He knows what's going on, and he's my getaway. He makes it seem like he has no actual responsibility or cooperation with this bank heist, but because he knows what's going on, he is also part of the means through which I am doing this. He is now materially or informally cooperating with the action of the bank heist. He is the means by which I escape. If, however, he had no idea what was going on, and just we stole his car and made him drive and said, drive, then he's no longer responsible because he had no say in this. He was held at gunpoint, corrosion. He did not know the plan, so he was ignorant of what's going on. and although he's a means, he's not intentionally a means. Therefore, he is cooperating, but on a very remote level, to the point where he is not responsible for the bank heist. What about my accountant? I know, it's weird to think of a robber as having an accountant, but in this situation, he's going to have an accountant. The accountant, running the books, sees that my finances are low, and encourages me to go and perform a bank heist that I may have more money in my account, and he can have more funds to work with. He is not formally cooperating. He's not the one performing the bank heist. He's not providing the means. He's more or less giving the encouragement. Therefore, he's a mediate cooperating individual. He doesn't cooperate in the sense of being part of it, but is giving the encouragement and the drive to make it happen. He's the one that told me to do it. Therefore, he's responsible for encouraging that idea, but not for the action itself. So in this way, the principle of cooperation breaks down the various ways in which we can cooperate with an immoral action. Formal cooperation is the person who does it. Informal is the one who provides the means or helps with it. If under informal cooperation, it breaks down further into mediate, someone who is right there doing it, helping with it, such as the guy holding the tellers at gunpoint, and mediate, someone who is an intermediary between the actual event and what's going on, such as my accountant who's encouraging it. The immediate cooperation breaks down further into proximate and remote. Proximate means it happened then and there. Remote can trail on for a long time. It can continue into the effects way into the future. We'll get to one of those situations where remote cooperation applies. And the further we get from the immoral act, the less responsible we are for that immoral action. Okay, with my bank heist out of the way, let's go to another fun example. All my examples in this moral theology series are very dark. Makes sense because they're immoral, but I realize how dark they are. Because my next example is torture. This is actually a still common issue. So let's say the government has both legalized and encouraged the means of torture. I, as a government official, have been tasked with performing an interrogation which could lead to torture on a captured person. So, as the interrogation goes on, I feel it necessary to begin torture techniques to get the information we need. As the person torturing this individual, I am now formally responsible for the act of torture. I am morally culpable for torturing this person. With me, however, are several of my associates who provide the tools, keep the guy tied down, and help me in the act of torture. They are not physically torturing him, but are immensely helpful with the very process of torture. So they are materially cooperating with the action of torture. Behind them is a series of people who do the cleanup work. They jail him, they take care of him, they clean up the mess after the torture, because it's kind of a messy ordeal. How are they responsible? Well, that's a really interesting question. As jailers, they may know the person's being tortured, and if they care for him in such a way as to make his torture easier the next time they decide to torture him, or do things to allow him to be tortured even more, then they are now cooperating on an informal but yet material level. They are mediating between the actual act of torture and their job of caring for or cleaning up after this man. If, however, their job is simple, they are to care for him and to make sure he's healthy and well taken care of, and their goal is simply to clean the cells and take care of him, then they are no longer materially cooperating, but they are doing simply their job, and may have no understanding that this torture is happening. Okay. While this torture is happening, there's a guy behind a glass wall who's watching it. His job is to ensure that things go properly. This can be done in two different ways. So on one level, he could be complicit and agreeing to the torture, that he feels this is the best means, and therefore he's ensuring the torture actually happens. Now he's materially cooperating as the means through which it is ensured to happen. He could, however, try to take the moral high ground and say he's ensuring that the person's dignity is kept and the proper procedures are put in place so that torture is truly the last means necessary, that everything else has to fail and the only other way we can get this information is through torture. Therefore, he's trying to keep the whole act moral. And his job is thus. He is still somewhat cooperating with the act of torture since he signs off on it, but is trying to ensure that it's the last means possible. In the same way, there is someone above me who ordered the torture. He's my boss, the sergeant. He is now materially cooperating because without his word, without his directive, I would not do it. Unless I like torture and therefore just torture for the fun of it, then I am formally cooperating and very responsible for the act of torture. As directed and given orders to torture, my cooperation actually decreases. Although I am formally cooperating with the act of torture, and my official above me is the material means through which I do this torture, I am still under corrosion. And as corrosion, I am forced into the act of torture, I am now not as responsible since these are my orders. There's one more level. There's a guy who synthesizes the information we get from this act of torture. He compiles the information, ensures that it's correct, and then brings it to the proper places. Is he responsible for the act of torture? No. He just gets information. He has no idea how it's gained. He may know it's from torture, but he is completely powerless to stop it, and is just simply doing his job of using the information as he sees fit. In this case, he remotely cooperates. Very, very, very remotely. Because his actions do not affect it, and yet he is still affected by it. His job is contingent on this torture. I hope you see from these two examples how the principle of cooperation can apply in many situations, and more importantly, how to understand and address our own cooperation with immoral actions. How responsible am I for complying with someone's actions? How much should I comply with it? A good common example of the principle of cooperation is enabling. When we provide the means through which someone continues in a lifestyle or an immoral action without challenging or changing, but instead complying with and supporting it. The principle of double effect, we have lots of situations in which it's not what the ideal is. We have to do something that seems immoral or looks immoral, and we have to figure out how to apply it. What do we do? If you have any further questions about these, please feel free to email me at frcwilliams@holycrossmt.org. Hope to see you for our next session.